Today on Maine Calling, a comprehensive new guide to Maine's amphibians and reptiles. 33 years ago, the University of Maine Press published a science book unlike any other in its catalog at the time. It was a guidebook created by citizen scientists. About 250 people had volunteered to search for and make notes on frogs, toads, snakes, turtles, newts, and salamanders in their area. The results were collated in the first edition of the book, Maine Amphibians and Reptiles. I'm Jennifer Rooks. A brand new third edition of that guidebook just came out. 3,000 people contributed to this one. Today on Maine Calling, we will meet some of the editors and we will learn what they discovered as they tracked the cold-blooded vertebrates that call Maine home. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to island and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Do you just love the sound of spring peepers? Do you turn over stones to find salamanders? How about snakes? How do you feel about snakes? Well, we will learn about the variety of amphibians and reptiles in Maine and hear from some of the dedicated people who have compiled a comprehensive atlas of the species that can be found in Maine. Joining me for this hour, Malcolm Hunter, Professor Emeritus of Wildlife Ecology, and Libra, Professor of Conservation Biology at the University of Maine. Philip DeMaine. Philip, say your last name. I practiced and now I can't say it right.
DeMaine.
Thank you. Wildlife biologist with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. He leads the reptile, amphibian, invertebrate group. And he's with the graduate faculty at the University of Maine, and Trevor Persons, who is a herpetologist with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. We invite you to join the conversation. What questions do you have about frogs, toads, salamanders, newts, turtles, or snakes? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Well, Phil, I'll start with you. I understand that the foundation for this brand new and beautiful book really started more than 40 years ago. Tell us about the Citizen Science Project, whose work has led to this new guidebook, Maine Amphibians and Reptiles.
Sure. Thank you, Jennifer, for hosting this program. Yeah, the people, I'm sure, in your audience have heard of wildlife atlasing as a phenomenon. It's become so popular and important for gathering data in Maine. And this project, the Maine Amphibian and Reptile Atlas Project, was the very first wildlife atlas project in Maine and quite possibly in all of New England. So yeah, running for 40 years, it's generated a wealth of information. It was a brainchild of Mac Hunter, and in collaboration with Maine Natural Areas Program, Maine Audubon, and our department. And over this period of time, it's generated over 20,000 records, individual observations, mostly by citizen scientists, but also scientists. And their numbers are, I believe, over 3,000 in number. So it's involved a lot of participation and a lot of good information. You know, two major goals are pretty basic to most wildlife atlases. One is to get as much scientific information as possible, you know, leveraging the help of trained volunteers, and the other is simply public outreach and awareness. And I think we've, by all measures, accomplished both to a large extent. There's quite a constituency now out there, if you can call it that, of reptile and amphibian aficionados, and very eagerly and enthusiastically contributing records.
Well, Matt, congratulations. I didn't know that this was your brainchild some 40-something years ago. Could you have imagined that it would lead to the kind of knowledge and that we have today?
No, it really is quite extraordinary how things have changed in 40 years. One of the many reasons we have produced a third edition of our book on Maine amphibians and reptiles is just the extraordinary amount of information that has been generated, not just the 20,000 records that Philip mentioned, up from 4,000 when the second edition came out. But basic research at the University of Maine in particular, and many other institutions around the state, a number of some dozens of research projects, mostly led by graduate students, have unfolded. And so our basic understanding of these animals that not everybody sees on a day-to-day basis. They're not like the birds perched on the tree in front of the house there. But they're out there, and we have slowly learned a lot more about them. This new edition of the book has 600 new references. That's one little measure of just how much more we know about them than we did 25 years ago when the second edition came out.
All right, well, Trevor, I'm going to ask you for some basics. Maine amphibians and reptiles. What do we have here in Maine? I know we don't have crocodiles. I understand we don't have lizards. What do we have?
So we have we almost have lizards. There's a skinks are a lizard, and they're found in a couple other New England states. But yeah, so we just have frogs and toads and salamanders and turtles and snakes. Those are the four groups we have. And how many we have really depends how you want to define it. We have 38 species total that we deal with in the book. And there's nine frogs and toads, nine salamanders, nine snakes that still live here. And then turtles is more complicated because we have, there's 32 species of native terrestrial or freshwater species. But then we have one introduced salamander, the mud puppy. That's firmly established. We have timber rattlesnake, which used to occur here but is extirpated now. And then we also have three marine turtles, sea turtles, that most people will never see, but they're out there in the Gulf of Maine. And then we have a box turtle, which is people sort of have argued and tried to figure out whether they've ever been truly native or not. So the number is anywhere between 32 and 38, depending on how you define what's a real resident of Maine.
And one thing I learned from this book, Mac, it's interesting because reptiles and amphibians are often grouped together, not just in guidebooks, but also in study, but they're really not related to one another. Talk to us about the difference and why we group them together, even though reptiles are more related to birds than they are to amphibians.
Well, we group them together because they have pretty similar habitats for the most part, and they share some features like being cold-blooded is the common term. More complicated thing gets into how their temperatures are regulated by the environment more than physiology, etc. But in fact, as you suggest, they are not actually closely related. The amphibians are much more closely related to fish, and anybody who's watched a lot of stuff about dinosaurs has figured out that birds are really kind of are actually a kind of reptile, and both birds and mammals are more closely related to reptiles than they are to amphibians. But we lumped them together partly because the kind of people who are intrigued by them are similar, and we lumped those people under the kind of squishy name herpetologist.
I love it, herpetologist. And one thing I learned from the book is that I think it's in the section on the milk snake that a herpetologist would never be found saying the sentence, "You have a snake problem. There's no such thing." One thing I learned looking through the book, Philip, Trevor mentioned that the timber rattlesnake had been extirpated. I think there are many people who don't even know there ever was a rattlesnake in Maine, that a lot of people, including myself, have said one of the best things about Maine is that there are no venomous snakes. But you not only, call attention to it, but you dedicate the book to it. This book is dedicated to the memory of Maine's timber rattlesnakes in the hope that we will lose no other members of our fauna and flora. So tell us when timber rattlers were extirpated, and was it intentional? What happened?
Yeah, this is really one of the sad black eyes of Maine's biodiversity history. Timber rattlesnakes were not ever abundant in Maine. We think they were probably restricted to some hilltops and mountains in southern Maine, but they were here. And Maine is now one of only two states across the entire range of timber rattlesnakes that no longer have them, for which they're extirpated, Rhode Island and Maine. And there are rumors that occasionally circulate that we do have timber rattlesnakes still. And honestly, we would, as the herpetologist that you're speaking to right now, would be thrilled if that were true. And we would be the first to champion their conservation. But we do indeed think those are rumors. It's really been since 1860, since the last confirmed timber rattlesnake record, I believe. Trevor's nodding, so I know I'm on safe ground.
So a long time.
Yeah.
Were they intentionally killed? Was this farmers that didn't want them around?
Yeah, they were. They were persecuted because of
persecuted.
I mean, I don't think there's another word for it. Really, they were intentionally, gassed and captured and killed and decapitated in large numbers. So, yeah.
Wow. Trevor, this edition of the book has a lot of beautiful color photographs, and I understand that you are the photographer of many of these. How hard is it to take a picture of something that's so small, many of them meant to blend into the environment, and hard to find?
It depends. Patience is probably the most useful tool to have. Probably the majority of the photos, like in the book, are animals that have been captured briefly and then set back down, because it often is very hard, other than a turtle basking on a log, or it's often very hard to get a photograph of an amphibian or reptile completely in its natural state. But oftentimes you can catch a frog and coax it to sit still for a minute, and then it's just a matter of trying 30 times, as it tries to hop away until it finally does sit still in the perfect position for you. But it's always an interesting endeavor taking pictures of these things.
And Mac, let's talk about some of the things that these 3,000 citizen scientists, 20,000 records have taught us in this edition of the book, Maine Amphibians and Reptiles. What do we learn that we didn't know before?
Well, we have a much firmer idea of just the distribution of these species around the state. We did very well at getting to remote parts of the state. There was a handful of key people who traveled the remote parts of Aroostook County, et cetera, and all the members of the editorial team were very active in getting out to remote areas. And so at the end of the day, we've learned that there are really only two reptile species, the wood turtle and the garter snake, that are found throughout the entire state. Many species, snapping turtle would be an example, that are widely found throughout the state, but there are gaps in their range up in the extreme northwestern part of the state, as far as we can determine. Of course, you can never prove a negative. You cannot prove that something is not there, but we have pretty good ideas that there are lots of gaps in the distributions of reptiles. It's a different story with the amphibians. For the amphibians, 11 of the species, we have 17 species of amphibians. 11 of them are found throughout the state. They're obviously much more tolerant of colder temperatures than the reptiles, as a generalization. We even have one interesting sort of counterexample of a mink frog that actually reaches the southern edge of its range in Maine. Most of these species are petering out as the climate gets colder as you go up into northern parts of Maine. But the mink frog is actually absent from southern Maine and reasonably common in much of northern Maine.
Have we seen a shift, Mac, in the reptiles and amphibians that are coming to Maine? We know that we're seeing many more birds because of climate change than we used to. Are we seeing, as the climate shifts, more creatures or greater numbers of certain creatures?
Well, the we do have one species of turtles, the red-eared sliders, that are not established in Maine, but the people release them as pets. They're not expanding their range into Maine, but they show up here, and nowadays they survive here, but they are yet to breed. I suspect with continued climate change and with people continuing to release them inappropriately, I might say, into the environment, that we might end up with red-eared sliders breeding here. In my lifetime, I have a strong feeling, but I can't prove it, that the gray tree frog has shifted its range to the north to a significant extent, but we don't really have the data to prove that. Philip, Trevor, any other thoughts on?
I was
Yeah,
just going
Trevor,
to
go
add,
first. Yeah, go ahead.
we have one small. I think we all kind of agree with Mac about the gray tree frog, that it seems like it's been expanding a little bit, but it's a little hard to prove without having really solid data from 30, 40 years ago. But there's one small case where the Skudik Peninsula of Acadia National Park, which a lot of people are probably familiar with, it's that is a place that actually has had a lot of visitation and even a lot of research, like dedicated amphibian surveys in the 1990s, with no records of gray tree frogs on that peninsula. But then just in the last 5 or 6 years, they've showed up there, and they've reached all the way down to the southern point of the Skudik Point. And so they were probably always on the mainland, three, four, you know, interior, 3 or 4 miles away, but they certainly have seemed like they've colonized that area in the last, just in the last decade or so. So that's a small
Yeah.
example over a few years. So you can imagine over 100 years, it's probably going to be much more dramatic across Maine.
Yeah, I want to come back to the gray tree frog after the break. But Philip, what did you want to add to what you've learned that is exciting to you?
Well, just big picture on this point of changes that may have been noticed. One of the really important contributions of a wildlife atlas like this is that it provides a baseline of our current understanding of the distribution and abundance and status of species. And so these questions that we're speculating on about the gray tree frog and others that might change as a result of climate change, we'll be able to answer that much more clearly with the next generation of the atlas, because we'll have this data captured in very spatially explicit format. So it's a powerful tool, and one that I think will be increasingly important with the effects of climate change for understanding wildlife distributions.
Well, we're talking about the brand new guidebook, Maine Amphibians and Reptiles. What are your questions about amphibians and reptiles in Maine? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Some of the 38 different reptiles and amphibians in Maine are easy to spot. Some you hardly see at all, but all of them are featured in a new atlas that paints a full picture of what species live in Maine. Joining me today, some of the experts who helped put together that atlas. Philip DeMaynadier is a wildlife biologist with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife and graduate faculty at UMaine. Trevor Persons is a herpetologist with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. And Mac Hunter, UMaine Professor Emeritus of Wildlife Ecology. We invite you to join the conversation. Already the questions coming in. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or comment on Facebook or Instagram. Joining us now is Aram Calhoun, who is Professor Emerita of Wetland Ecology at the University of Maine. Thanks so much for calling in.
Yes, thank you.
You focus on vernal pools. For people who don't know what a vernal pool is, tell us and tell us why they are so important.
Vernal pools are spring pools or temporary wetlands that generally dry down by the summer's end. And they're special because they are ephemeral, so permanent fish populations and lots of invertebrate predators are not there or are less abundant than they would be in permanent waters. And there's a very specialized group of amphibians and very charismatic, the blue-spotted salamander, the spotted salamander, and the wood frog, and a charismatic crustacean, the fairy shrimp. And the reason that they're doing well in vernal pools is because they don't have some fish.
And right, fish aren't eating their eggs. Right.
That eating their eggs, eating tadpoles, they are delicious. They don't have chemical deterrents like permanent pond breeders do. And why they're important in Maine is sometimes a matter of opinion, but what people don't realize is that vernal pools are not just about the amphibians and crustaceans that live in them, but they're really fast food oases for either eating in or takeout as animals hop away. They actually can turn leaf litter into a biomass in the form of amphibians and invertebrates that can feed a lot of terrestrial species. And dotted throughout the landscape, vernal pools are often the last parts of an upland to still have wetness in them. So a lot of animals in the, like snapping turtles and some snakes will dig that bank down into the soil and excavate. We call that, you know, keeping cool in the summertime. But basically, it's that it's a highway of exchange of materials and energy between the upland and the wetland.
And Aram, I know that in some places, our vernal pools are, disappearing. Tell us how we're doing it. This has been an effort for a long time to try to get people to think differently about vernal pools. Are we succeeding? Are we saving them?
So that's a really good question. I think as with the atlas that Mac was talking about and all the years of research, we have a much better idea now of how to conserve vernal pools because we've learned so much about not just the vernal pool habitat, but what we call the post-breeding habitat, like where do all the adults go after they breed and where do the juveniles go? And with this information, we're better able to craft policies to help for the long-term conservation of vernal pool ecosystems, which includes the pool and the surrounding terrestrial habitat. And that's a new way of looking at it. Like Massachusetts was way ahead in conserving vernal pools, but they just put little 50-foot so-called buffers around them, and they were finding that the animals were disappearing. So now in Maine, we know that we need to think about connectivity between the pool and other habitats in the upland where the animals spend 95% or more of their time, and we know that they migrate much farther distances than we ever imagined. So we are able to guide towns and interested landowners in ways that they can conserve their own pool, land trusts in a way that they can provide connectivity between vernal pools and other wetlands, which we know the animals use, and just helping to keep that. I guess that the most important thing is when people think about vernal pools, when we conserve them and forested habitats, we're actually conserving highways for a lot of other species. A lot of animals, mammals, birds feed in vernal pools or depend on food that leaves the vernal pool. So it's like maintaining wildlife connectivity for a broad array of wildlife in Maine that we care about, like moose and deer and mink and raccoon and herons and barred owls, etc. So they're really nodes in the terrestrial landscape of food and refuge.
Well, Aram, thank you so much for calling in. Aram Calhoun, UMaine Professor Emerita of Wetland Ecology. We have so many questions coming in. I will start with an email. I have a feeling you all will love this question. This is from William. What are the brilliant blue salamander about 6 inches long that have found in the leaves in my mid-coast backyard? Matt, go ahead.
It sounds like a simple question. And the simple answer is the blue spotted salamander. It's a nice prosaic name for that works very well. It's actually a surprisingly complicated answer if I were to get into the depths of it, because these blue spotted salamanders have sort of complicated genetic variants, let's call it that. And so we talk about a whole complex of hybrids that form. And I think I'll stop and just say, buy the book if you want to hear the full story, because it gets very, very complicated and too much to cover here on the air.
Okay, but the short answer, blue spotted a salamander. Before the break, we were talking about the gray tree frog, and I want to be clear that it's the gray tree frog, because when you say it quickly, it might sound like the great tree frog. It's gray tree frog. And one of the things I love about this book is, on top of all the really great scientific information, is that each entry starts with something, you know, maybe a little philosophical or a little quirky about each animal. And on that one, Stephen Russell writes, with their three lollipop-shaped toepads and flanks the color of the summer sun, it might seem that the gray tree frog are too exotic for Maine. Their true eccentricity, however, is in their cells, wherein lie four sets of chromosomes. So I was just wondering if any of you want to talk about what your favorite little factoid or anecdote about an animal in this book is. Trevor.
Well, I don't know. That's certainly a good one, because gray tree frogs are fascinating when you realize that they're actually there's a look-alike species in the southern U.S. That has the normal two sets of chromosomes just like we do, but the gray tree frog is presumed to have arisen from hybridization from some extinct relatives of that group, and ended up with double the normal number of chromosomes. So it's a very odd species indeed. But
well, Philip, what about you?
Yeah, I just want to circle back very briefly to your point about the little hooks that we put in front of each species account, because we actually went back and forth about whether to do that. You know, it's not something you would traditionally see in a field guide or other scientific volume, but we hope they're successful at sort of drawing folks in, and by having when we asked the contributors to generate these, we said think of generating just a little haiku about your species and drawing the audience in, and then we quickly migrate to scientific narrative. But yeah, the one story I might share is that one that really took me by surprise is the mud puppy. And that This exotic amphibian, Maine's largest amphibian by far. It's a huge salamander, 10 to 12 inches in length in the Belgrade Lakes region. And I was studying it with some colleagues, looking at its diet and distribution in which lakes it had colonized. We had a bunch of them in the lab, in my office in Bangor. And I had my back to the tub where they were and was doing some data entry or something. And I heard this chirping coming from the tub. And I turned around, and many of the mud puppies in there were making this high-pitched sound. And I guess if I'd been a well-trained herpetologist, I would have known that already, because that is a known fact about mud puppies. But I think most people don't realize that, most people assume that salamanders don't make any noise. And that's one of the distinctions from frogs and toads, but that took me aback, and that was interesting. And I guess that's perhaps also the origin of the name mud puppy, is because of that chirping
Sound like
sound.
puppies. Yeah, that's right. Mac, do you have one?
Yes, I will turn to the leatherback sea turtle. It's really quite an extraordinary species. It's so big, they weigh up to 2,000 pounds, and we, on the cover of the book, we make a point of our species range from a dozen that you could hold in the palm of your hand to some that rival a moose in size. And I've been lucky enough to see leatherback turtles twice off the coast of Maine. They are so big that they are sort of warm-blooded, back to using that somewhat sketchy language. And they do perfectly fine in our waters. They paddle on from here on up to Nova Scotia. And so we tend to think of sea turtles as vagrants that get lost when they should be in tropical waters. But the leatherback turtle is a unique creature that actually does very well off our coast. And they're there, but in very small numbers.
We'll go to Josh, who's calling from Washington County. Hi, Josh, go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I'm just wanting to relay an anecdote and maybe get an answer. I'm pretty sure I know the answer is no, but when I was 10, I was down in Sebago Lake State Park hiking through the woods, and I swear that I caught a timber rattler. Kind of coincides with the range that you gave earlier. However, you said they were extirpated in the late 1800s, so chances are probably slim. And then just a follow-up question, what kind of conservation status do we have for our amphibians and reptiles? Are there any threatened, or are they all just least concern, or what's the status? And that's it. Thanks.
Phil.
Yeah, I'm gonna let Trevor answer the timber rattlesnake story, and then I'll talk a little about species status if you want.
Go ahead, Trevor.
Sure. Well, probably because 95% of the time, it's the milk snake that trips people up into thinking they found a rattlesnake. Partly because the pattern of bright blotches along the back looks like it doesn't look a lot like the timber rattlesnake in New England, actually, but it does look a lot like sort of a lot of classic Western rattlesnakes that people are familiar with. And also, milk snakes have the habit of vibrating their tails when they're disturbed. And if they vibrate it, if they're in dry leaves or something, it can actually produce a sound. And it's kind of a blur, so you can't really see what's happening with the tail. And they can be pretty large. They can be a good 3 feet, which is quite a bit bigger than a lot of the small garter snakes that people are used to seeing in their yard. And so if you're unfamiliar with a milk snake and you come across one that's acting defensively, that can certainly get some people's heart rate up, and
And probably
that's
still a good idea not to try to catch it or mess with it, right? Phil, what were you going to say about endangered species in
Yeah.
Maine?
I will just close that out by perhaps not try to catch it, but please take a picture of it. That's how you generate new records for the Maine Amphibian and Reptile Atlas Project. And that's how, if there ever is a timber rattlesnake documented in Maine, we'll be able to confirm it. Yeah, so the timber rattlers are extirpated, but we have quite a few other species that are at risk in Maine, if you don't include the non-native and marine species. About a third of Maine's reptiles and amphibians have some kind of state official conservation status as either endangered, threatened, or special concern, which is a high percentage. One in three of the animals in this group. And unfortunately, that's a pattern that's also mirrored globally for the group.
What
But
are the biggest threats? Are they development, pesticides?
yeah, good question. One of the reasons I think amphibians and reptiles are so threatened as a group is because it's kind of all of the above for them. The long and with habitat loss being right at the top of the list. Mac mentioned earlier about what one of the things we learned was that there's a concentration of reptile species in southern Maine. That's the highest richness of turtles and snakes is in southern Maine. And that's a pattern that's also true for many other taxa. We think of the wilderness of northern Maine as being the haven for wildlife, but in fact, the highest biodiversity numbers are in southern Maine. And that's also where we have the highest rate of population development, land conversion, road traffic, least amount of public conservation land. And that combination really makes it a challenge, especially for our endangered turtles that are limited to York, Cumberland, and coastal areas. Another big threat that there's several. It would take a program to talk about the threats and issues and projects we're doing to try to address them. But I'll just mention one other. There's a couple threats that are sort of unique to reptiles and amphibians, and that just adds to the list that they're in, of stressors they're encountering versus other taxa. And one of those is road mortality. Obviously, that's an issue for a lot of wildlife, but it really is a big issue for Maine's turtles because of their population ecology is such that adult survivorship is key. They're very long-lived, but they're late to mature, and just the loss of a few adults regularly from a population can drive it down to extirpation. And so there are some hopeful projects that are underway to address road mortality. You may have heard of the Big Night project.
Yeah, we did a Maine calling program on it.
That's
Yep.
right. Yeah, that was a great program. So Greg LeClaire works for our department now, thankfully, and he's the Big Night champion. And it's a great way to get folks out in bucket brigades and helping to move animals and identify road hotspots. We also have a signage program for endangered turtle crossings in southern Maine, where we seasonally deploy signs bracketing segments of road where, through telemetry data, we've determined there's a high rate of crossing, just to flag drivers to be careful. And thirdly, I'll just mention another sort of road-directed project, and that's wildlife underpasses. That's sort of the Cadillac and the best of all of the above, but it's also extremely expensive. We did successfully put one in Elliott not too long ago on Route 236, where there's 16 to 18,000 vehicles a day, and it was the largest turtle mortality hotspot in the state, including many Blanding's turtles, state endangered species. Since we put up since collaborating with Maine Department of Transportation and installing a large box culvert under that problematic section and putting in wings, fences to funnel them towards it, there's been almost no road mortality whatsoever. And we know that because Derek Yorks, one of the contributors to this volume, one of the editors, did the before, during, and after data collection for that project. So
Well,
that was
speaking
great.
of Derek Yorks, we're going to hear from him right after the break. And Derek's also going to tell us about the state reptile and the state amphibian. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about amphibians and reptiles, and especially about a brand new book, the third edition of Maine Amphibians and Reptiles, just out. It is the product of a very large citizen science project that has been going on for more than 40 years. Our guest today, herpetologist Trevor Persons, wildlife ecologist Mac Hunter, and wildlife biologist Philip de Maynaudier. Share your comments and questions, 1-800-399-3566. Well, as promised, I do have Derek Yorks with us, who's a wildlife biologist specialist specializing in reptiles with Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Derek, thanks for joining us today, and tell us about the state reptile and the state amphibian.
Thanks, Jennifer. Yeah, so as of just this year, Maine now has a state reptile and a state amphibian. So we joined the ranks of, I think, somewhere around 30 or so other states that have state reptiles and amphibians. So our state amphibian is the spring peeper, and that's a species which I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with, at least in terms of what they sound like, maybe not what they actually look like. But the spring peeper is found all around the state. They have this unmistakable chorus that you hear in the early spring. And to me, and I know many other people out there, when you hear the spring peepers for the first time, that's when you know spring has truly irreversibly arrived and winter is coming to an end. So I think it's a great species to represent our state and how important spring is to Maine when it finally rolls around.
Yes, it is important. State, what about the reptile? Yep.
Yeah, so the state reptile is the wood turtle. So it's a species that's less familiar to people. They are a special concern species in Maine. They are found all over the state. They're a really beautiful turtle that's found in clean, clear rivers and streams, predominantly in forested areas. And so in many ways, they're emblematic of kind of the best of Maine's natural areas and kind of a species that depends on being a unpolluted and wild environment.
And I understand you are a turtle expert, Derek. Is there anything else about any of the turtles in Maine that you think people just have to know? What's a great bit of trivia or a fact about Maine's turtles?
Yeah, I think one thing that's, from years of fielding emails and calls from the public about turtles, one thing that is kind of fun and interesting about turtles is that they sometimes will overwinter in their nests as hatchlings. So turtles typically nest in June. And this is most common with painted turtles, which are our most common turtle species in Maine. But rather than hatching out of their nest late in the summer, early in the fall, like most other reptiles, many will actually stay in the nest chamber and stay there for the entire winter and not hatch out until the following spring, and often in May. So people will find these small little hatchling turtles that still have the egg tooth on the end of their snout in the spring and kind of wonder what's going on. And those turtles, in fact, just hatched out of their nest and overwintered on land. So that's a cool thing that I think not a lot of people know.
Great. Well, Derek, thank you so much for calling in. And I understand you, as well as Aram, who called in earlier, Aram Calhoun, are also editors of this wonderful book, Maine Amphibians and Reptiles. Derek Yorks, a reptile specialist in wildlife biology with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. We're going to go up to Presque Isle and Tom. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just kind of a fun story. We moved up here to Presque Isle. I grew up in the South around the space program, so I was very familiar with tree frogs. And we moved up here. It was getting quite cold. And we had a pump house separate from the main house. And I went out there, and we had there was a small ice chest there, a small square ice chest filled with vermiculite, which is that white stony material that you use to mix up potting soil with. And I pulled the cover off. Just, I don't know why I had to pull it. And here are four or five small beige colored, from what I remember, again, this is 30 years ago, had worked themselves down into that perlite, made themselves a little nest. And they were tree frogs, right? I mean, with the long fingers and the suction cups on their toes. Blew me away, because that was the last thing I expected to find. Like I said, I was ignorant of what's up here on Maine. I did not expect to see tree frogs.
Well, yeah, Tom, thank
nice
you.
Home.
Yeah, thanks so much, Tom. And Mac, this is what you're saying, that amphibians can handle northern Maine. So Presque Isle and tree frogs, well, there you go.
Yep, they. I mean, some of the most extraordinary things are there are species like the wood frog and the spring peeper that can practically freeze. They have constituents in their blood that allow them to become. We refer to them as frogsicles at times. So yeah, the level of adaptation is quite extraordinary.
We have an email here from Greg, an easy way for folks to get involved is to log your amphibian and reptile sightings in Maine on the Naturalist app, on the iNaturalist app. Can't wait to get the latest copy of the field guide. Mac, how does somebody get a copy of this? Is this in bookstores?
Yes, in the bookstores, not all, but many of them around the state are carrying it now. Inland Fish and Wildlife just announced, I think it was yesterday or the day before, the availability at their website. You can order it there, and actually we've heard they're sort of flying off the shelves, doing very well at the IF&W site, and then directly from the University of Maine Press, they have a website. I think all these some links will be on the Maine Calling Facebook page that people can access.
For sure. An email here from Sarah. My children and I found what looked like a small red salamander in our wetland in Hancock County a decade or two ago. I think we figured out it was a red eck. Does that sound right? Do we have these in Maine? Who wants to go, Trevor?
Sure. Red eft, EFT is probably what, which is, that's the juvenile and terrestrial stage of the eastern newt. Newts are aquatic, but the immature stage lasts a few years, and they're bright red. They have a few little orange spots on them, but and they're not very palatable to a number of animals like birds and stuff. Which and the, so the red is actually a warning coloration. Yeah, so they're pretty common. If you start turning over logs and things, the red Fs are quite numerous out there.
But what I might add that if you start turning over logs and going through leaf piles and the things, the other salamander that you're even more likely to find is the red back salamander, which can look quite red depending if you're looking straight down on it. Some of them are gray, some of them are red, and the density, we did a study down in Arousic, Maine, where we had densities of in excess of one per square meter. So literally thousands per acre.
Wow.
They may well be the most abundant vertebrate animal in the state of Maine. But they rarely come to the surface. Basically, the only time you're likely to see one walking around in the forest floor is on a rainy night.
Here we go. We have, let's see, from Mike, could your guests please comment on which Maine amphibians or reptiles are superstars in pest control or rodent control? Phil, I'll go to you for that.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot about amphibians and reptiles as prey and their value in our ecosystems for that reason. But they're also valuable as predators in their own right. In terms of sort of pests to humans, I would say, milk snakes and racers are pretty adept at catching rodents and eating them. Snapping turtles can feed on carrion and keep our waters clean. And that's not, a formerly live animal. And smaller snakes, ring-necked, red-bellied, brown snakes, garter snakes are important predators of all kinds of garden and lawn pests, beetle larvae, slugs, snails. So really are quite valuable in that regard as predators.
I think
We'll
they're
try
capable
to.
in the world.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Matt, go ahead.
I haven't seen it documented, but I know there are people that believe that toads are really important in terms of control of pests in gardens. People in Europe put little toad houses in their gardens.
We just have a few seconds here. Maggie wants to know, she misses some big frogs that she used to see after rain in her driveway. She lives in York County. Are there light green frogs that used to be abundant that are not?
Maybe at any given spot, things could change. But yeah, we have three light green frogs, the bullfrog, the green frog, and the mink frog. And collectively, they're still pretty common around the state.
All right. Well, we are out of time. I know people have more questions. I apologize, but an hour is an hour. So thank you all so much. That was Mac Hunter, Professor Emeritus of Wildlife Ecology and Lieber Professor of Conservation Biology at UMaine. Philip de Maynaudier is a wildlife biologist with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, who leads the Reptile Amphibian Invertebrate Group. And Trevor Persons, a herpetologist with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Today's sound engineer was Chris Bridges. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Public Radio.